afternoon. How are we today? We have a PowerPoint presentation. We have the microphone working. I have a good crowd here, the Monday before Thanksgiving podcasters, and so I'm going to ask somebody to dim the lights, and we're going to start talking about monarchy and empire, AD 14 to 161. Do you feel better now that your papers are done? Yes, you feel better now that your papers are done and you only have a final to worry about. I'm sorry, what did you say? What else are you worried about? I have a student who said he enjoyed writing his paper. That makes me happy. I'm thankful for it. GSIs, did you hear that? Okay, I'm going to lecture today on a whole bunch of things. We're going to talk about the Roman city just a little bit, patterns of settlement in their various forms, and then we'll talk about the transition of rule from Augustus to Tiberius. And right at the very end, I'll just tell a few good stories about Caligula and Nero, and then we'll come back to Nero maybe again after Thanksgiving, just because I can't help it. Just a little relish for the Thanksgiving table. So when we do come back, I will continue with the joys of bread and circuses, the Flavian and the Antonine emperors, you all know about those, who generally are credited with making Rome and the Roman Empire into a stable infrastructure, making the empire flourish. So we'll talk about that, and we'll also talk a little bit about the Jewish revolt, the Second Sophistic, and the early development of Christianity. Oh, that's a big, big order there. Then on November 28th, Dan, you will be lecturing on the Severan emperors and the crisis of the third century. Is that correct? That is correct, he says. And this will be followed by Jesse on December 3rd, who will discuss, I hope he's going to discuss Constantine. I don't see how he can not discuss Constantine. The development of full-scale Christianity as an organized religion, and the philosophy of Augustine. And that's a good thing, because I don't know much about Augustine, and Jesse knows a lot. So that's a good thing. So if you've been doing a little extra reading in your source book, that nice fat book called The Historians of Ancient Rome, if you've done a little extra reading and you read The Life of Augustus by Suetonius, anybody do that? One person. Excellent. Well, then, if you did do that, you might have noticed that Augustus was very proud of his achievements, and I'll just quote Suetonius about his achievements in building. Since the city was not adorned as the dignity of the empire demanded, and was exposed to flood and fire, he, Augustus, so beautified it that he could justly boast that he had found it built of brick and left it in marble. Okay, here's some marble. You remember back when we were with the Mycenaeans, and I showed you a citadel and a baby on a citadel? Well, here's a toddler on an altar. See her? There she is. All right. I'm showing you a marble altar known as the Ara Pacis, or the Altar of Peace, which Augustus dedicated in 9 B.C., It's one of a very large number of monuments that were built in Rome at this time, both by Augustus and by his successors, and it's a building with a message. The fruits of Augustan peace are symbolized in a very traditional and tasteful way. We have an incorporation of Greek artistic traditions with Roman forms. So the altar is, to a certain extent, Roman. It's frontal, to a greater extent also it's Hellenistic, and its artistic motifs are done in a Greek style, a classicizing style. And we have all kinds of beautiful things on it. We have garlands, we have bucrania, or the heads of sacrificed bulls. We have flowers and rosettes, all kinds of lovely things. All these flowers and fruits and animals made possible by peace. Okay, what's this? This is an allegory, basically, an allegorical scene on the altar. It might be personification of the goddess Roma. It might be peace. It might be Italia. We don't know. She's not labeled. She's got two little babies. Maybe they're Romulus and Remus, or maybe they're just generic babies. Babies symbolizing fertility. Animals, all kinds of nice animals. Maybe this is Venus here riding on her swan, her favorite animal. That would make sense since she's the mother of Aeneas. And the wind maybe here or something else. I'm not quite sure what that is. No one is. We just don't understand what's going on, but we respond to it. It's lovely and peaceful, no matter what it means. And here are the people who make it all possible, the family of Augustus, dutifully worshiping the ancestral gods, reestablishing order in the empire. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later in the lecture, but just keep this sort of idea in mind. Augustus wants everyone to know that he and his family are the bulwark upon which peace rests. So let's leave this now and get Rome from mud and brick to marble. And then we'll go on and we'll talk about Augustus and his political settlements. Okay, so early Rome was established here on a ford of the Tiber. It's a little island here called Tiber Island that makes it easier to get across the river. It's got seven famous hills. It was always swampy, but it was convenient, as these things go, for trade and transport. The Tiber was navigable a little bit further north and certainly further south. The Etruscans, our friends the Etruscans, drained the swamps. They established a citadel on the Capitoline. They built a temple to Jupiter. It had three cellas, or sanctuaries, and this was typical for Etruscan temples. Jupiter was in the middle, and on either side he had Juno and Minerva. The Romans called this the temple of Jupiter Capitolinus, or Jupiter Optimus Maximus. Not Optimus Prime, not a transformer, nothing like that. Okay. Now these were the three chief divinities of the Roman state: Jupiter, Juno, his wife, and Minerva, his daughter. And that's a little bit different from what we pick up in Greek religion, and it is associated fundamentally with this first establishment of Etruscan religion. The Romans were extremely conservative people, and they stuck to this. As I said, they were conservative. They liked things to stay the same, and when all those fires and floods that were talked about in Suetonius, when these would come through periodically and destroy the city, the Romans had a tendency to rebuild, and they would rebuild in exactly the same way. This is a relief of Marcus Aurelius from the 2nd century AD triumphal arch. And there is the temple of Jupiter. Just exactly as it was. Well, maybe not exactly as it was, but pretty much in exactly the same place with the same form, with the same three interior cellae. Which brings me to this very strange, strange picture. Some holes in the rock. What is this? Why are we looking at holes in a rock? The Romans like to say that they had preserved the original house of Romulus on the Palatine, the very house, and that these are the post holes of this dwelling, which were excavated much earlier in the, very early in the last century, on the Palatine, exactly where this particular house was supposed to be. This sort of living history museum should be familiar to any of you who have been dragged to Sutter's Fort. Who's been to Sutter's Fort? Yeah. Okay. And who's been to the Sanchez Adobe? A couple people. And who's been to Paul Revere's house in Boston? Anybody? One person? Good. Exactly the same sort of thing. These Historical places are interesting and quaint when we visit them, but they have a very strongly political message about citizenship, continuity with the past, cultural authority. That is the sort of idea that the Romans invented, shall we say. So, the Casa Romuli, the House of Romulus, apparently lasted into the 4th century AD. We have references in some of the orators that it was still being maintained in the 4th century AD. It had been rebuilt over and over. They would just rebuild it exactly the same way. They stuck to the customs of the ancestors. And here we go. This is a reconstruction of what it ought to look. Talk about a mud hut. I mean, can you imagine any self-respecting demigod living in this hut? But, you know, built character in the Roman way. Fair enough. Fair enough. So in the early 4th century BC, when the Athenians, in the 4th century BC, they were just picking up the pieces from the Peloponnesian War. This is just to sort of tie things together so that you kind of remember why we studied the Greeks, because they'll be on the final. So while these Athenians were picking up the pieces in the 4th century, they were brewing up hemlock for Socrates, that sort of stuff. At Rome, people were getting out of their mud huts. They were expanding. They had conquered Etruscan settlements. They'd expelled the Etruscan kings. They had conquered Etruscan settlements at Veii in 390. The city was sacked by migratory Gauls. And in response, they built their first walls. Now, although these walls are called Severin, after Severius Tullus in the 6th century, the Romans thought that the walls came from the 6th century. They come from the 4th century. And they were built in response to this 4th century sack, and they defended the city. And they were, to a certain extent, the boundaries of what you would call Rome proper, although the city itself expanded well out beyond these original boundaries. Now, Rome itself was always a chaotic place, not really a typical regular Roman town. It grew up in an organic fashion along the river with these hills. It was never comfortable, especially for your average person to live in. But the Romans took up town planning with a vengeance outside of their hometown. And the towns took their form not only from Greek ideas about straight streets, but from Roman military planning, famous military logistics. So Gates is really pretty good about this. He illustrates this particular camp, which is in Germany. Novaesium. I've never been to Novaesium, but it could be like any camp that the Romans built anywhere. Exactly the same. A castrum. Everything is always the same, so you know exactly where you're staying after your march. You set up your tents in exactly the same place, or if you're going to stay longer, you build your barracks in exactly the same way. It's a square. In this case, it's a rectangle. Straight streets, crossing at right angles, commander in the center. Okay? Commander's house, commander's tent in the center. Everything else arranged around it on the streets. And often these camps developed into permanent towns. For example, these are the examples that Gates gives, and there are lots of them. Colonia Agrippina, which is Cologne now, or Eboracum, which is the town of York in England. And another example of this is a place called Casa. Again, this is something how many people did read the Gates? You read the Gates? It's been on the syllabus. Yes, I got one person who read the Gates. Well, now you should read the Gates because it's very, very interesting. Casa started out as a colony, for Roman soldiers, founded in 273 on land conquered from the Etruscans. Remember, we talked about how this was always a really big problem for the Romans, what to do with their veterans once they had completed their service. Well, if the Roman legion was particularly lucky and they conquered someplace in Italy, they might live in a place like Casa. So Casa is set out with these nice straight streets intersecting at right angles, although it does take advantage to a certain extent to the topography. I think I've got that's a better slide where you can see it. So we've got this capital or citadel up here on a high point. We have a forum here, and then houses grouped around. It's not completely excavated, I believe. There's still a lot of work to do, but it's been beautifully published, and you can read all about it. As I said, it was founded in 273. It's got straight streets. It's got a citadel. What else have I got? And it's got this capital, this temple, up here on the citadel. What's left of it, anyway. And you can see something else that's very important for the Romans. It's concrete. And we're going to come back to that in the next lecture. Gates is very, very good on this as well. He explains it very nicely. Concrete is a mixture of lime, sand, water, and usually some kind of aggregate. Let me repeat that. It's a mixture of lime, sand, water, and something else that you put in to make it stick together. Sometimes it's gravel, sometimes it's rocks, sometimes it's shells, and very frequently the Romans used volcanic sand to give a really strong kind of bonding agent. And although we take concrete for granted now, in its time it was revolutionary. It allowed the Romans to do all kinds of amazing things. And I'll come back to that as we continue on with the empire. But when Augustus wanted to build his, this is the capital. This is a reconstruction of the capital temple of Jupiter, almost certainly. Again, frontal, we've got this stone base, and then the rest of it would have been built with concrete and facing. All right, but Augustus had to build in marble. He was going for something impressive, and he borrowed from the vocabulary of the Greeks, but used also native Italian forms with the frontality of the temple and the stairs, which are typical of the Etruscan temple. Okay, so when he wants to build his marble city, and we're just going to take a look at his forum, as I said, he borrowed from the Greek vocabulary. He was going for something impressive. He wanted the building to look like it was made of stone, an enclosed area framing this magnificent temple, the temple of Mars Ultor, Mars the Avenger. And, of course, the message is very clear. The killers of Julius Caesar have been avenged. So, you can say it in words, but a building is much more impressive. Here's what's left of it, and you can see to a certain extent that Augustus is fudging. I mean, he's got the stone facing on the stairs, but underneath you've got concrete, ashlar blocks for the foundation, but there's concrete. So, we borrow the vocabulary from the Greeks, but the methods are entirely Roman, and they create their own special form. So let's talk about Augustus and his handing off of power, this transmission of imperial power. Because although we think of Augustus as being the first emperor, as being the first citizen, as being the princeps, it's not a formal office during his life. He's pretending that he's just a normal citizen, a very powerful citizen, but he's pretending that he's just a normal citizen. So let me remind you of a couple of dates. 44 BC, Julius Caesar, the last big Republican figure, was assassinated. In AD 14, Augustus died, and Tiberius became the first Roman to assume the official position of emperor. So it took 60 years to separate the last Republican from the first emperor. And you've got to kind of think about what's binding those two bookends together. There's a dynastic thread that runs from Caesar to Tiberius, and we've got this very important bridge between Augustus, his adopted son, and Tiberius. Augustus, who is Caesar's adopted son, and Tiberius, who is Augustus's adopted son. Let's just talk about that. There's Tiberius, looking very handsome and youthful. I'll go back to this. So Augustus had this problem. What's he going to do when he dies, as I said the last time? What would be transmitted? What kind of power would be transmitted? Would it be his whole position, a combination of legal powers? Would it go on for a long time? Would the Republic be reestablished, etc.? Would it be unchallenged? Did he need another charismatic person to carry this on? It's very hard to transmit your own charisma. And so the question dogged Augustus, really, right up until his death, who was going to succeed him. And of course, you have to remember, life expectancy is very short. Life expectancy is about 35. He was on borrowed time right from the beginning. He could die at any moment. So why didn't he just return government to the Republic? Well, he had consolidated his personal power to a degree that it would have been impossible. If he had given up his personal power, he and his family would almost certainly have suffered from, shall we say, the feuds that had gone on during the Republic. They'd almost certainly made too many enemies to survive, and so they had to, from a personal point of view, hold on to their power, and also in terms of an administrative situation. It would be too difficult to transfer back to the traditional ways of doing things in the Republic, with consuls coming in every year, things changing constantly. So who was to succeed? Now, there hadn't been any kind of dynastic succession from father to son, since those nasty, unpleasant Etruscan kings. But Augustus was very determined that he was going to keep the succession within his family, that he ought to form a ruling dynasty. And so we get some very tense dynastic politics going on over the course of Augustus's life, and they were quite a cast of characters. So we've got Tiberius. Let's start with Livia here. Now, Augustus was adopted, as we know, by Julius Caesar, so he became a member of the family of the Julii. He married Livia, who already had sons, Tiberius and Drusus, and she was a member of a different family, the Claudii. So would it be the Julii or the Claudii who were going to dominate? So Augustus, of course, wanted to start out by keeping things within his own family, the Julii. He had a daughter by a previous marriage. Her name was Julia. Now, he didn't have any qualms about using Julia as a dynastic tool. He married her off to whomever seemed suitable at the time, and she mostly went along with it, at least in her early life. She was first married to Augustus's nephew, Marcellus, the son of Octavia, and her first husband, Marcellus. Now, you'll remember, anybody remember who Octavia was married to in addition to Marcellus? Anybody remember? Octavia was, in fact, married to Antony before he went off the deep end with Cleopatra. She had children with Antony, but Marcellus was born to a perfectly unobjectionable gentleman whose name was also Marcellus. And so Augustus groomed him, this nephew, as his political successor, married him to his daughter, and everything seemed great, until the young man died in 23 BC. As I said, life expectancy is very short. So Julia was promptly married off to Agrippa, Augustus's most prominent general and political ally. He had commanded the ships in the decisive battle against Antony and Cleopatra at Actium. And this was an attempt to bridge the divide between Augustus's political partisans, nobles, and others who felt that they deserved something from Augustus. This was an attempt to bridge that with his own family. Now, Julia had, with Agrippa, three sons and a daughter. Two of them, Gaius and Lucius, were adopted by Augustus as his heirs, And so they were being groomed as his successors. And he had a younger brother. The two older brothers had a younger brother, Agrippa Postumus. When their father, Agrippa, died in 12 B.C., this wasn't such a big deal, but when Lucius died in 2 A.D. and Gaius in 4 A.D., Augustus was, to a certain extent, in trouble. Agrippa Postumus turned out to be unsuitable. So he is again lacking an heir, a male heir. So Julia dutifully married Augustus' stepson, Tiberius, the son of Livia, who was the highest ranking member of Augustus' inner circle at that time. And he had to be the heir. He was really the only one left. And so Augustus adopted him as his son and gave him the key constitutional powers of Imperium Maius and Tribunitia Potestas. So, I mean, he was clearly being groomed. Now, Augustus's plans were always being foiled by these untimely deaths within his family, but nevertheless, there was a political consensus that this figure of Augustus as emperor was of critical importance. It was important for Augustus to remain emperor, and the imperial family as an institution in all its branches was also important for the maintenance of that power as well. When Augustus died in 19 AD after a brief illness, Tiberius reportedly took action immediately after his death, and he wrote letters to all of the Roman armies because the armies were very, very important. He wrote to the consuls at Rome, the commanders of the Praetorian Guard, the imperial forces that were inside the city to keep Rome under control. He wrote to the Senate, and the urban populace and the Senate all swore an oath of loyalty to him and all of the other constituencies. Everybody swore an oath of loyalty to Tiberius, because what else were they going to do? What else were they going to do? They needed someone at the head. They needed an executive. But it wasn't all easy. It wasn't all simple. Tiberius convened two different meetings of the Senate. The first meeting, in September, arranged for the funeral honors of Augustus. And this included a formal deification. Augustus was now officially a god, not just a god in conjunction with Roma. Now, the second meeting, a little bit later, mid-September, was devoted to clarifying Tiberius' position within the state. And this was a lengthy, tense discussion. And it is recorded in Tacitus, and that particular passage of Tacitus is in your reader. And I hope you'll read it. GSIs, are you going to discuss that passage in the annals? No? It isn't necessarily on the reader, but you might have thought you might want to mention it. No? No. Okay. No extra reading. Nobody wants to do any extra reading. But take your reader if you want to take a look at it. So, there's Tiberius, and he's in the Senate. And the fundamental question, you know, what should we clarify? Tiberius is Augustus' son. He was adopted in 4 AD. He's been awarded two-thirds of Augustus' estate. He's got all the power anyway. He's been voted that, even before the death. But even more significant from a legal perspective, you know, Tiberius already had the Imperium Maius. He had the power to command the army, and he had the tribunician power. He had the two constitutional bases of Augustus' power. What else was there to discuss? Well, there was a problem. Augustus' position was built up over a 45-year reign. There was no precedent to transfer his power to someone else. No real precedent for making sure this happened quickly, within a day or two. And there was no telling whether senators who were ambitious might try and challenge. And, of course, Tiberius wasn't as charismatic as Augustus. By the end of the meeting, it was clear that Tiberius hadn't really gotten everything he wanted. He hadn't gotten all the love he had expected to get, but he had gotten the Senate to undertake to transfer this position of Augustus to Tiberius. It was this abstract notion of protectorship, a duty that Tiberius had to take up on behalf of Augustus, that Augustus had been the steward of the empire, Augustus had been the steward of the empire. The empire needed another steward, and Tiberius was the only person who could take it up. All of this was discussed in the Senate in these two meetings. And so it was agreed Tiberius would be the next Augustus. Now I'm just going to quote to you about how graciously Tiberius accepted this offer of the whole world. Tacitus says that, wearied by the assembly's clamorous importunity and the urgent demands of individual senators, he gave way by degrees, not admitting that he undertook empire, but yet ceasing to refuse it and to be entreated. In other words, he said, well, if I have to, I guess if I have to. But instead of saying it in a nice way, he said it in a cranky way. And he said it in such a cranky way that everybody thought they were going to be executed afterwards. All right, so he's not as charismatic as Augustus, but he's definitely very, very powerful. The Principate is passed, and the Julio-Claudian dynasty begins. Founded by Augustus, who was had experienced a relatively smooth transition of the power within the family to Tiberius. Tiberius ruled until 37, when his nephew Caligula took up the empire, followed by his uncle Claudius in 41 BC, and Nero, the nephew of Claudius, in 54. All right, there were a few kind of, you know, bumps along the way, but this blueprint for imperial succession survives intact for the next 220 years. There are a few heads rolling around on the streets, a little blood every once in a while, but for the most part, this is how things work for the next 220 years. And the empire outside of Rome itself continues making money, building roads, going to the baths, going to the games, having a good time, unless, of course, you were a slave stoking the fires or something else like that. So while this empire is flourishing nicely, imperial bureaucracy, as I said, roads, taxes, everything you need to be a Roman, with a capital R, there was a small group of individuals who were connected with the imperial family that always jockeyed for power. Okay, and there's some great stories connected with all of this maneuvering, and I just have to mention them since they loom very large in Western thought. Okay? This is what everybody remembers about the Julio-Claudians. And let me ask you, what do you know about the Julio-Claudians? Let's start there. What have you heard about them? Heard anything? Never heard of them. Never heard of Caligula. Oh, come on. You've heard about the burning of Rome under Nero. I know. I see somebody smirking who's heard of Caligula. Nobody's ever heard of Caligula. Just from the reading. Just for the reading. Yes, I see a hand. He declared war on the ocean by stabbing it, by throwing a trident in it. Not exactly the most balanced behavior. And nobody's ever... His horse... somebody's heard about his horse being made a senator. Nobody watches movies. Oh, nobody sees movies? Well, all right. There's an X-rated movie called Caligula. No, that's a TV show. That's not the X-rated movie. Oh, you guys are behind on your education. What am I going to do with you? All right, here we go. Let's talk about a few of these things. Tiberius had been a really, really good general for Augustus. He had consolidated all of these territorial gains, especially in Gaul, but he was a very brutal general. And as an emperor, as I said, he wasn't particularly charismatic. He was said to be miserly. And he was also rumored to have had an extraordinarily cruel streak, to have been a sexual predator on a monstrous scale. No one was safe in his villa. And you can find all of this in a complete version of Tacitus, as well as in Suetonius, although it's expurgated from your reader. I wonder why. Okay, whoops. Come back here. Now, Tiberius's difficulties with his heirs are included in all of this discussion. Come back here. And let's just talk about that. He's got these problems with his heirs. And it culminates these problems with the succession in AD 37 of Caligula, his great nephew and adopted son. Okay. So here's Caligula. He's an interesting fellow. His mother was Agrippina, the daughter of Agrippa. You get the pattern. And her mother, Julia. So Augustus was his great-grandfather. His father was Germanicus, a famous general. You can read about Germanicus in your reader if you want. And he was himself the son of Tiberius's brother Drusus and Antonia, the daughter of Octavia and Anthony. So really, Caligula could not have had a better pedigree. He's got Augustus, he's got Anthony, he's got Agrippa, he's got all these really famous noble Romans. And his ascension was greeted ecstatically. None of this silly stuff about needing to be coaxed into taking the job as we had with Tiberius. Nothing ungracious about it. But he just wasn't real good at being an emperor. He spent all the money, and he wasn't particularly good at being a general. There have been some attempts to rehabilitate him, but he seems to have had two big problems. As I said, he was very unsuccessful militarily. He stabbed the sea with a trident and turned around and went back. Not exactly inspiring of confidence there. And he had a really bad habit of alienating or executing far too many people of influence. We don't need to worry too much for the purposes of this class about whether the stories of his excesses are true, but I suggest you read them. They're really interesting. We don't have to decide whether it's true, whether he really did enroll his racehorse in the Senate, or whether he forced the wives of senators to work as prostitutes in a private brothel to raise money to cover his debts. It really doesn't matter. Caligula was failing at being the chief executive. He was endangering the orderly fabric of the empire, and he had to go. He was assassinated, 41 AD, and his elderly and physically disabled uncle, Claudius, was installed instead, the only suitable candidate still alive from the family. Now, Claudius was an outstanding administrator, although he's got his detractors too. He's famous in modern literature through his novelistic treatment by Robert Graves. We mentioned I, Claudius. Has anybody seen the TV show? One person. Oh, how are you feeling back there, GSIs and... You're feeling great. How do you feel about your students never having seen I, Claudius? If they should watch it. It's a lot of fun. It's a great novel. It's not exactly history, but it's a great read. All right. Claudius was an excellent administrator. He has his detractors. He executed people when he felt like it. He did what he had to do. He's most famous because he married his own niece, Agrippina the Younger, the sister of Caligula, the mother of Nero, who became Claudius's heir and succeeded him in 54 AD. And Nero is famous for being a loony, obsessed with his singing career. He went all over the empire forcing people to listen to him sing. Not inspiring of confidence. And he didn't do anything in terms of being a military hero either. No, he just didn't get it. He didn't get what he was supposed to do. Even Claudius, with his limp and his stammer, you know, knew that he was supposed to go out and be a general. Claudius went out and captured Britain, for which we owe all kinds of wonderful things. Great straight streets in London. All kinds of wonderful villas in England. Claudius had the sense to know that in order to legitimate himself, he needed to be a military commander. All right, so Nero was a loony. He was also really young. He was about 16 years old. And in the early part of his career, he was kept under the tutelage of his mother, Agrippina, and his tutor, the philosopher Seneca. But when he got a little bit older, he decided that he could run things himself. He got tired of having his mother tell him what to do. He put her in a boat that was leaky and that would collapse. She was a strong swimmer. She made it back to shore. So he sent some Praetorian guards to stab her. That worked. Okay, so when we come back after Thanksgiving, we're going to let Nero sing his swan song, and we're going to go on with the emperors who get it, with the Flavians and the Antonines. Do I have any questions? You should read everything that's been assigned in Gates, okay? Up until this point, you should read everything that's been assigned in Freeman. And think about, once you've read Freeman and Gates, taking a look at your reader and seeing whether the primary sources have, in fact, been included for you to just check up on us. Do I have any questions? Yes, I have a question. Was the problem of the erratic behavior of the emperors a problem for the citizenry at large? Probably not until they spent all the money. If they were just chopping up nobles or forcing noble women to serve in brothels, it wasn't a big deal. But if there wasn't enough money to pay the troops, if there wasn't enough money to build roads, if the taxes were being collected too vigorously, that's a problem for your average citizen, all right? So that would be the reason why emperors such as Nero and Caligula are deposed. It's a combination of their erratic behavior which leads to a problem in administration and in cash flow. And, of course, to keep up the administration and the cash flow, you have to pay attention to the army. You have to give the army something to do. Another question? Anybody? Have a great Thanksgiving. Oh, you did it?